In the coming week, Americans celebrate Independence Day. The Arctic continues to face a dramatic heat wave. And Hong Kong reacts to China's sweeping new national security legislation. It's July 2nd, 2020, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Jim Lindsay.
And I'm Alice Hill, sitting in for Bob McMahon.
Alice is CFR's Senior Fellow for Climate Policy. Alice, it's great to have you on The World Next Week.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Jim. Let's kick off this show by discussing this weekend's 4th of July holiday right here in the United States. As Americans prepare to celebrate their 244th Independence Day on Saturday, how would you characterize the mood of the nation?
Well, Alice, it seems to me that Americans aren't in much of a celebratory mood. Indeed, I think the country seems despondent and uneasy. I will note that Monmouth University just came out with its poll showing that 74% of Americans think the country is on the wrong track. That's a pretty high number. Just 21% think the country's on the right track. And it's easy to see why so many Americans are concerned. We have the coronavirus pandemic. That's produced a major downturn in the economy, a great deal of uncertainty where the economy's going. The killing of George Floyd has brought to light and highlighted structural racism in the United States and the issue of police brutality. All of this has taken place against the backdrop of what is clearly deep political polarization in the country. And of course, we're 4 months and a day away from a next presidential election, and elections have a tendency to divide people rather than bring them together. So I think it's a birthday of great concern. I really can't think of one in my lifetime that has had so much, I think, concern and despondency attached to it. That doesn't mean that people aren't going to go out and celebrate in ways, though I note that in most states and most localities, officials are urging Americans to stay home for the 4th of July, precisely because of the pandemic, which regrettably, because of the way we responded, we haven't been flattening the curve. We've been seeing cases actually begin to soar. I don't know, perhaps you're more optimistic than I am as we celebrate the 244th birthday of the United States.
Well, I work on climate change. It's hard to feel more optimistic when you're looking at the current picture of our political climate, and then the actual climate is greatly heating up. So much uncertainty and so much confusion currently. I do believe this is one of the most difficult Independence Days I've experienced in my lifetime as well.
I want to ask you, Alice, because you are by training a lawyer and you for a period of time are a judge, or perhaps I should refer to you as Judge Hill. But, you know, one of the sort of topics sort of floating around in the public conversation about whether America's lost its way is this whole question of what is happening to the rule of law. That rule of law is being eroded here in the United States for a whole variety of reasons. And you have people sort of worrying about whether, you know, we are seeing the American democratic experiment begin to erode. Again, given how deeply you've been involved in legal issues over your career, to what extent do you give credence to those concerns? To what extent do you think they're overblown?
I believe that the rule of law is very threatened at this moment. You know, our whole system of government here rests on the confidence of the people in the institutions. That's the legislative branch, the executive branch, as well as the courts. And confidence in those institutions has greatly decreased, including, I'm afraid, in the court system. It's now viewed as more politicized. We're learning more about challenges with racism in our court system. And I think with that, people feel adrift as to what institutions they can rely upon. When I was a judge, I was very conscious that if the litigants who prepared before me in my courtroom, and I was just one of thousands of judges across the United States, didn't have confidence in the decisions that I rendered and how their voices were heard, there's really not a barrier between that and chaos. And that's why we have these systems in place to help govern us so that we can live peaceably with one another. But in recent years, we've never seen so much, certainly in my lifetime, of denigration of those institutions that many of us grew up relying upon as our guides for how we should make decisions going forward.
You know, I'm curious about that, Alice, because I've been reading a lot of history recently about the early years of the American Republic. And one of the things that struck me was how small a role the courts, and particularly the Supreme Court, played in American politics and the functioning of the system. So much so that John Jay, who at the time was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, left the United States to go to Britain to negotiate a treaty with the British. He was gone for, I think, close to 9 months, and the country continued. Whereas today, you know, we not only sort of spend a lot of time thinking about what decisions are the courts going to make. I already got 3 or 4 news flashes in my email inbox today because of cases the Supreme Court has agreed to hear. And we now all of a sudden talk about Republican judges and Democratic judges. And that leads me to think, you know, to the extent we get to this vision that justice is itself politicized, is there any way to walk that back? Because it seems to me that's deeply troubling if people view the outcome of a case being determined by the political affiliation of whoever appointed that judge.
Well, I think that we cannot assume, based on political affiliation, how a judge will rule. I was a judge for 13 years, and most of those I was a supervising judge. So I got to know new judges, judges who'd been on the bench a long time. And a political affiliation wasn't necessarily a guide to how a person decides to rule in a case. You know, once you put on that black robe, and it's a requirement in most courts, many courts at least, that you wear that robe, and that's a symbol of the office. It indicates to the litigants that you're the person in charge of the courtroom. Once you put on that robe, it tends to change people's thinking because they have a greater appreciation that they're part of a system and that their political views, we swear that we'll uphold the law, so we should have put aside our political views and decide each case as it comes before us. And in fact, most of the justice is rendered in our state court systems. We tend to focus on the Supreme Court very visibly, but most of that justice is not even rendered in the Article III, the federal courts that we hear so much about, the appointments under President Trump. They happen in the state courts. And in the state courts, that's a very different type of business. It's all general jurisdiction. They handle everything. And it can be politicized, but in some instances, it's not. One real Achilles heel we have in the United States is that so many of our state court judges are elected. So you'll remember that de Tocqueville, when he toured the United States, pointed out he couldn't believe that all these judges were elected in the United States and predicted that that would be a terrible form of justice for us. And in fact, it does challenge our ability as judges to be fair, as one justice in California said, and I guess that reflects that most of the judges are male, said, it's hard to ignore the crocodile in your bathtub when you shave in the morning.
Yeah, so that's a great line. I like that. It is an issue, I think, that justices are elected in a climate in which people place so much emphasis on what decisions are made. And it clearly, you know, we look at state elections, same as federal elections, turnout tends to be relatively low. You tend to get the most motivated people going to the polls to vote. So you have a tendency to sort of skew justice one way or the other. And I think that's been a backdrop of it. I just note, you know, you mentioned Alexis de Tocqueville. He wrote Democracy in America. It is a very long book, but I would recommend all people read it. Now, I had several years of college students I assigned it to, and they always grumbled because it was rather long. But I think he may be one of the most perceptive commentators on American politics. And of course, he was writing back, what, the 1840s, and he still got right a lot about what is still the case in American politics. I will note, Alice, of course, that while, at least in my view, the American public seems a bit downbeat going into this particular 4th of July, there still will be 4th of July celebrations. I note that President Trump is heading out to South Dakota, to Mount Rushmore, where there is going to be a major fireworks display. This has caused a lot of controversy about the propriety of doing so, in good part because of the fear that the fireworks could touch off a fire in South Dakota around the memorial. I don't want to get into whether it's right to do that or not, but it seems to me this takes us back to an issue that you spent a lot of time working on, which is climate change. And sort of the Mount Rushmore issue is sort of a small snippet of a much broader story. And what has sort of really struck me as I've been watching this debate about should we have fireworks at Mount Rushmore or not, is the news coming out of the Arctic Circle where there has been a major heat wave. And my understanding is that in some parts of Siberia, temperatures have exceeded 100 degrees. And for those of you who don't like the Fahrenheit scale, I should say, on the Celsius scale, that's 38 degrees. days. So can you just sort of take this sort of snapshot? I take it that we normally don't see temperatures above 100 degrees Fahrenheit in the Arctic. What are these developments telling us, Alice?
Well, that was a stunner. It was definitely record-breaking. A town in Siberia, which, by the way, does experience extremes in temperatures. Its previous extreme was 98.96 Fahrenheit, but it also had set a record for one of the coldest places in the world as a low of minus 90 degrees.
Wow, that's quite a swing.
Right. And it's a place known for that. And heat waves are known in the Arctic. They occur all around the world. What's unusual about this is the amount of sustained heat that we are experiencing in the Arctic. Over the past 4 years, the annual surface air temperatures in the Arctic have been the highest on record. And the Arctic is warming twice as fast as the rest of the world. But what happens in the Arctic doesn't necessarily stay in the Arctic. There are ramifications for the rest of the world from this heating in the Arctic, as well as for the people who live there. So what we see is these temperatures are causing ice to melt. And we have land ice. If land ice melts, that goes into the sea and that contributes to sea level rise. But we also have sea ice. For the first time, certainly in modern recorded history, we are seeing an entire ocean open up for exploration since the days of Christopher Columbus. And because that ocean is opening up, we have a geopolitical interest in what's occurring there, but we also have some added heat to the rest of the globe. As the ice disappears from both the land and the water, it would get rid of that white color and it turns much darker. And with those darker colors, there's more heat absorbed into the land as well as the oceans, which contributes to our heating up.
Or to put it the other way around, as long as you have snow, the snow can reflect some of that sunlight back into space.
Exactly, the albedo effect. So it's going to go back up and it's not. So that's contributing to higher temperatures globally. And then we also know that those who settled in the Arctic have lived with a very stable climate for a long time, and they've assumed that the permafrost remains permanently frozen. But we now have 4 million people living in these areas, and the permafrost is melting. So the infrastructure that has been constructed there is basically crumbling, caving in, sinking as a result of this. In fact, last month, the land supporting a Russian oil storage tank buckled. That caused the tank to collapse and break. We've had one of the largest oil spills yet in the Arctic as a result of this. 6,000 tons of diesel oil spilled into the tundra, and then another about 15,000 tons have ended up in the waterways. And once they get into the waterways, it's very hard to remove that oil. And of course, the conditions of removing oil, it's a very harsh environment. Warmer, it has had warmer temperatures, but historically it's harsh. And so that complicates matters greatly. By 2050, on the course we are for warming, we can expect about one-fifth of the structures and infrastructure that we have in permafrost in areas in Russia will be threatened. And that will cost Russia over $80 billion. It's very expensive to build in these regions.
Alice, am I correct in understanding that if we continue to see temperatures rise in the Arctic and the permafrost ceases to be permanently frozen, that that's going to have an accelerating effect on climate change? I mean, I recall the first major conference I went to on climate change was way back in 1988. And I still remember seeing a graph where somebody said, you know, if you were to take these trends, go all the way out in the future, if the permafrost melts and all of a sudden you're going to release a lot more carbon because a lot of dead rotting material has been frozen. Once it's unfrozen, biological processes take place, decomposition and release of carbon dioxide. Is that still the case?
Oh, you're absolutely right. That's a concern that the methane, which is, of course, the greenhouse gas that's the most damaging, it heats the most, it's shorter lived, but
I said carbon dioxide.
Heating.
I should have said methane.
Well, there's carbon dioxide that will occur as a result of this, too. So we will see greater heating And scientists are worried that we will get on a path that we can't reverse because this melting of the permafrost and then the release of the gases that are in the permafrost will just continue to contribute to heating in a way that we cannot control. So you were right in 1988 to be concerned, and the concerns have not lessened at all over time.
So you're talking about how these temperatures in the Arctic are sort of undermining the infrastructure for the Russians, but that seems to be a broader issue around. If you have rising sea levels and you live in a low-lying area, let's say Miami Beach here in the United States, you're going to have trouble with water rising up. Even if it doesn't come up on land, it can infiltrate aquifers that you draw on for water. I know you do a lot of work on resilience. Sort of, are you optimistic that we're going to be able to make a lot of progress on resilience, that it's finding ways to adapt to climate change? Or do you look at it and you grow more pessimistic by the month?
We will make progress on adaptation. That's what humans do. We adapt. So we will find ways to live with climate change. The human race, in my opinion, will survive. But we're going to have a lot of pain and suffering.
That's a pretty low bar, by the way.
Well, some predictions are we won't. I don't think that's the case. But I do know that there will be a lot of pain and suffering. And we are just at the beginning of this. You know, it's become dirty words to say managed retreat. But when you look at sea level rise, people are going to have to move away from the coast as their homes get soggy. CoreLogic, which is a property analytic firm, just came out with a study saying that from increased storm surge by, I think, 2030, 7.4 million homes will be at risk. That's $1.8 trillion worth of property. We have not really priced that risk yet through the mortgages that are being issued for those homes. We are seeing that those mortgages are being sold off. So some of those holders are getting rid of it, but it's still very, very much within our financial system. We are just waking up to the breadth and depth of the risk of climate change and also how quickly it's occurring. Similarly, on the West Coast, we are seeing wildfires that we've never seen in the 2017 and 2018 wildfire seasons in California. Those two seasons alone wiped out 25 years worth of profits for the insurance companies that have insured in California. These are surprise events, since to some extent, people didn't appreciate that areas that were not thought of as at high risk of wildfire would burn so fiercely and so intensely. Now that we understand what that looks like, we will see greater movement to adapt. But that means that the people who are already there, who may not have the means to move, who are very emotionally attached to their homes, it will be very difficult to have those conversations telling them it's too dangerous to remain where you thought your family could stay for generations. What's happening is that our climate is no longer stable. We're seeing changes that have never occurred at this rate and this speed within recorded human history.
Okay, Alice, you're not cheering me up.
These are the facts. We can measure. That's the irony. People say, well, I don't think climate change is happening. Observed recordation of changes since the 1880s make it absolutely clear that the climate is changing.
I agree.
Actually, and the percentage of people who don't believe that is shrinking, along with the polling that we see on other issues, as you've mentioned.
Well, let's hope we can get members of both parties to take action on it, because I think, as you point out, time is running out.
Well, we had an exciting event this week on that. The House issued its report, and now it is a Democratic majority report, from the Select Committee on the Climate Crisis, a huge report really covering all aspects of climate change. And this, for the first time, provides the nation a roadmap on all the different kinds of programs and policies and changes that need to be put into place to address the threats from climate change. So it's an important step forward. Of course, it depends on whether Congress implements it or not, but it reflects a lot of strong thinking about how we could do a better job going forward. Jim, let's switch topics now. Let's talk about China. In the last week, Beijing imposed a new national security law on Hong Kong that just came into effect on Wednesday, in fact. The law will punish Hong Kongers with crimes ranging from secession to subversion, terrorism, collusion with foreign forces, and it can carry a life sentence. So what's going on here, Jim? Really, what does this legislation mean going forward?
Well, Alice, what it means is that Beijing is putting its foot down and it is tearing up the contract that has existed with respect to Hong Kong since it was turned over to Chinese rule from the British back in 1997. That agreement, which was painstakingly negotiated, created this system we call one country, two systems. That is, Hong Kong would be under Chinese sovereignty, but it would operate by a different set of rules that was supposed to last for 50 years. And under the leadership of Xi Jinping, China's unilaterally changed the terms of that arrangement. We're seeing Hong Kong being subjected to the same kinds of rules that mainland Chinese have to observe. And this is coming about for a variety of reasons, partly because of the very strong democracy protests that have been animating Hong Kong politics for the last 18 months or so. You recall recent Hong Kong elections where the Beijing-backed slate of candidates were swept away because Hong Kongers don't want to live under the rules, particularly the rules regarding freedom of expression that Beijing promotes. And Beijing has made the decision that it can no longer tolerate that situation. And it's interesting, you know, this is clearly a major international move. It's not just a Chinese internal matter. It is an international matter because, again, the handover of Hong Kong was written up in a treaty. And you see in the United States, Great Britain, Australia, a variety of other countries criticizing the Chinese. I will also note that Beijing has been very quick to point out that more than 50 countries have supported China's new security law for Hong Kong. And these are countries that include Saudi Arabia, Syria, Zimbabwe, countries not known for having rules allowing for free and open expression. The fact that Beijing has cracked down is going to further increase tensions between the United States and China. The Trump administration has already indicated that it is going to revoke the special status that Hong Kong has under American law, which provided a variety of economic and tax breaks to the Chinese. So that's going by the wayside. And I think we're seeing just sort of a further deepening of the divisions between China and the United States and most of its friends and allies. The challenge for the United States is that to this point, the Trump administration in standing up to China has failed woefully in terms of rallying like-minded countries to act in concert, which has made it, I think, a lot easier for the Chinese to pursue these very aggressive, assertive demonstrations of their own power.
What do you think this will mean for Taiwan?
Well, I think this gives the people of Taiwan a great deal of concern. You know, it remains the case that China, mainland China, claims that Taiwan is part of China. This is one of Beijing's core interests. The people of Taiwan have shown no interest in returning or becoming under Chinese rule. Indeed, I think many Taiwanese would prefer independence. That's not politically or geopolitically possible right now. But I think this raises the concerns that President Xi and the Chinese Communist Party remain committed to reabsorbing Taiwan into China and fulfilling that vision, and that perhaps China might consider doing so forcibly. Now, there is a big difference between imposing a new national security law in Hong Kong, a country that is physically already under the control of Beijing, than it is to reclaim Taiwan. So I don't want to suggest the two are similar. But I think obviously this creates concerns in Taiwan and not just in Taiwan about what the intentions are of China under Xi, whether it will respect international law or whether it is going to, in essence, say might makes right, we're more powerful than you, if you don't like it, stop us. And again, that gets us into the discussions about what's happened in the South China Sea. China's ignoring international arbitration decisions about the South China Sea and a whole variety of other issues. But it's clearly a place of real tension in the world. Alice, let's move on to our figures of the week. Who or what is your figure of the week?
My figure of the week is Anne Hidalgo. She just won her second term as mayor of Paris. She's the first female mayor of Paris. And she won in what has been termed a green wave in this week's local election. In addition to her win, green candidates won across the country in major cities, Marseille, Strasbourg, Lyon, and Bordeaux. You know, in her first term, Hidalgo has been a leader on many things, but on climate in particular. particular. She has focused on sustainability. She ripped up some major throughways in Paris and exchanged them for green space. She turned roadways into bikeways, has increased the ability to bike through Paris. And she's also paid attention to one of the threats Paris faces, which is extreme heat. In 2003, Europe, as well as France, suffered a terrible heat wave. The deaths were terrible across Europe, but were very high within France. 14,000 people died. Excess deaths occurred. And France had this moment where they said, we're not going to allow this to happen again. So they have become leaders in preparing for extreme heat, which is a wise thing to do with rising temperatures, as we've discussed. So Mayor Hidalgo has set up 800 essentially cooling centers in buildings and green space to allow citizens as well as tourists to easily cool off, to just physically lower the temperature within the city during these extreme heat events. She's also paid attention to the types of extreme events that France will face, and in particular Paris, increased flooding. So she's installed a lot of pavement that's more permeable. It gives the floodwaters a place to go. That stormwater drainage system means that it averts flooding across the city. And as a result of that, it's made for a safer city. She's also recruited volunteers, it's kind of a volunteer brigade, to respond in the time of a disaster. And we see these disasters are worsened by climate change. So she's been a real leader in this space. One interesting thing going forward is what this green wave will mean for the election for Macron in 2022. His party, formed in 2017, didn't do particularly well in this current round of local elections. And certainly there's thought that this might push the entire nation and certainly Macron towards a more environmentalist agenda so that he can capture those urban voters who voted for the Green Party in this past election.
This, of course, takes us back to the point you made earlier, Alice, that the reality of climate change and disruptions caused by climate change are there. It's clear in the data. It's clear in people's experience. And we're beginning to see at least some political leaders begin to respond to those changes.
Yes, this is a new development. We're particularly seeing it right now in Europe. The European Union is beginning to lead on these issues, particularly in the absence of American leadership, simply calling out for further action, including that the stimulus packages issued globally should reflect some kind of environmental agenda to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and restore ecosystems. And how about you, Jim? Who or what is your figure for the week?
Alice, my figure of the week is a number, and it's 100, as in 100,000. It was reported this week that Russian intelligence paid bounties as high as 100,000 to Taliban soldiers who killed American soldiers. This caused a storm of controversy in the United States because it's not clear that the U.S. government has responded to these Russian actions. And indeed, it touched off a discussion as to whether or not President Trump had been briefed on this bounty program run by the Russians. Now, I'll note that the initial White House response was that the president had not been briefed. The initial White House response wasn't that the bounty program didn't exist. This led to further complaints that the White House defense didn't exonerate the president, that not knowing about it was just as bad as not knowing and not acting. So we've gone back and forth about whether the president has been briefed, the degree of consensus in the intelligence that they have found. But I'm curious, I wanted to ask you, Alice, because you've recently served in government. You served in the Department of Homeland Security. You're used to dealing with and have seen intelligence. You understand how the government process works. What do you make of sort of what we're seeing about the national security decision-making process in the Trump administration?
It's broken the mold. It's very unusual, based on my understanding of the presidential's daily brief, not to have an item like this surface. Of course, there's been discussion that it wasn't credible enough, but as I learned working with intelligence, it's not often that you get 100% certainty. All of this is pulled from a variety of sources, human intelligence, surveillance, other means of learning what's happening. And so the analysts do their very best job of alerting those who have the responsibility for the security of the United States to the risks that it may face. I recall what a general said with regard to climate change. He said, if you wait for 100% certainty on the battlefield, something bad will happen. And in my experience with intelligence, we need to look at and examine and consider even those items of information about which we don't have 100% certainty, because if we wait, we could be very vulnerable indeed.
I must say, I was surprised in sort of following this story that the president's advisors hadn't generated, as best we can tell, any response to this intelligence, even if it was uncorroborated, because generally speaking, one of the lessons of bureaucratic life is that when you have bad news, you always want to take some steps to protect yourself against charges that you haven't acted. And it just seems as if this information had sort of just bubbled around the national security process and no one had taken charge of it one way or the other to provide a record of what the administration had done. As best I can tell, senior officials haven't even argued that, you know, they asked for further explanation or further investigation of these charges. It all seems rather disconnected and really atypical for how the national security process is supposed to work.
I would agree. If you're the person being briefed and you receive this information, of course you're thinking, I don't want this to happen on my watch. I want to have done everything I can to make sure that I've mitigated the risk. As I listened to this, I recalled when I was a federal prosecutor many years ago, one of the assignments for junior prosecutors is that they review all the threats to the president. And I can tell you, as a junior prosecutor, I was very conscious. I did not want to decide that that threat wasn't material and then have the president killed. So we investigated very thoroughly threats against the president. And this was a little similar to me in my thinking. I recalled that story because this is terrible if it's true, and we need to address it. And as a person being briefed, I would hope that the response would be, we need to figure out right away as much as we know, and then figure out an appropriate response so that we end this, and then we don't see it in the future.
I suspect, Alice, we're going to be hearing a lot more about this story in the weeks and months to come that may fill in at least some of the blank spaces in this controversy.
I agree. And that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep your eye on. Another round of UK-EU talks begin in London. The new head of the World Trade Organization is set to be announced. And the anniversary of the coup that deposed former Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi is marked.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the host or our guest, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collins with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Special thanks to Madeline Babin, Anna Grazer, Noah Milligan, and Anna Shortridge for their assistance. This week, our recording engineer was Zoe Collis. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Alice Hill saying so long.